Well, greetings. This is Stuart Haynes, and welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care pharmacy practice. Now, we've all witnessed patients who are taking way more medications than they probably need, and this is especially true in older adults who often get prescribed a laundry list of medications for multiple chronic diseases and often take multiple over-the-counter products. Deprescribing has become one of the most important tasks that pharmacists need to address in practice today. Now, while we have consensus guidelines about medications that are high risk and should be generally avoided, like the Beers list, as well as the stop and start criteria for potentially inappropriate medications, we don't have a lot of data about when to de-escalate or discontinue medications that we commonly regard as lifelong therapy for chronic disease. So, for example, should we down-titrate or stop medications for heart failure if a patient has been symptom-free for more than a year and their left ventricular ejection fraction has improved or even normalized? Well, that's exactly what a recent study, affectionately known as the TREAD-HF study, published in January 2019 in the Lancet, attempted to do. Joining me today to talk about the TREAD-HF study is Jennifer Pruskowski from the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy. Dr. Pruskowski is a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and the recipient of the American College of Clinical Pharmacy's new Clinical Practitioner Award in 2018. Dr. Pruskowski has a keen interest in deprescribing, and she wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled, "If Your Heart's Not Into It, Do You Really Need to Take Your Meds?" And Jennifer, it's great to have you on the iFormRx podcast.
Thanks, Stuart. Great to be with you.
So before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing RL, a 68-year-old African-American man, in the primary care clinic today for a follow-up visit. The patient is a Vietnam veteran and has been followed in your clinic for more than 20 years. He has a longstanding history of high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, and gouty arthritis. Now, 3 years ago, he developed shortness of breath and his exercise capacity was significantly diminished. A cardiac echo revealed that his left ventricular ejection fraction was 35%, and he was started on all of the guideline-recommended treatments for heart failure, including an ACE inhibitor, a beta blocker, and a loop diuretic. And over the past 2 years, the patient has been largely asymptomatic and his exercise capacity has improved. A repeat echo was performed 2 weeks ago, and it revealed that his left ventricular ejection fraction is now about 53%. The patient during his interview remarks that he hates taking so many medications, and he's wondering if it's really necessary to take them all. He's currently taking lisinopril, 20 milligrams daily, and amlodipine, 5 milligrams daily, carvedilol, 25 milligrams twice daily, furosemide, 40 milligrams daily, plus allopurinol, atorvastatin, aspirin, and vitamin D. In addition, the patient states he uses coenzyme Q10 and CBD oil, which he purchases over the counter. He currently weighs 213 pounds, which is down 5 pounds from a year ago, and his BMI is 28.2. His blood pressure today is 116 over 68. His pulse is 62. He had a fasting Chem7 drawn this morning, which revealed that his blood glucose was 87. He had a serum potassium of 3.8 milligrams per deciliter, and his estimated GFR was 53 mils per minute. So before we talk about the TREAD-HF study, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that are going through your mind in a case like this? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And are there any additional treatment options you'd be considering at this point?
All great questions, Stuart. Thanks. So first, I have absolutely seen patients like RL that are just itching to come off some of their medications. However, as when initiating or recommending medications for initiation, deprescribing also requires careful consideration and a rational approach. So while it can be tempting to take the bait in someone like RL who is asking us to come off of some of their medications, it's still our job as pharmacists to pause and consider all factors. And so when we're talking about deprescribing, there are four main factors that we need to consider. two of which are patient-driven and aren't normally part of our operational process as pharmacists, and two are med-driven, which is why I think pharmacists are crucial in the process of deprescribing. So the two patient-driven factors for deprescribing are care goals and prognosis. So as pharmacists, we're great at identifying specific care goals. So we're going to start this statin for a goal LDL of less than 70 or 100. But sometimes we don't often think about the kind of more broad goals for a patient. Does this patient want a full speed ahead curative plan, or do they want a more comfort-focused treatment plan? And we almost never directly prognosticate patients. So how long before these diseases take their life? And most of the time unconsciously, but appropriately, assume that patients want to be full code and they're going to live forever. But sometimes, and maybe in RL's case, maybe not right now, but we're not going to be able to assume these factors forever. So having some of these hard conversations with patients and thinking about how long we have to optimize their care is absolutely important. So once we know a little bit about their patient care goals and their prognosis, the other two factors are medication-driven, and these factors are very similar to the traditional comprehensive medication review core elements. So we're talking about treatment targets and time until benefit, but what that translates into is, you know, why are they taking these medications? When were they started? Is the patient having some issues with adherence? Are they even taking some of these medications? Are they burdened by cost? So for me, right away, I'm wondering about the treatment target and the time until benefit for some of these meds. To start, this aspirin. And by the way, thanks to you and Dr. Kirstie Perry for a great review and podcast episode right here on iFormRx regarding the role of aspirin in primary prevention. It was great. And, you know, I'm also wondering about this treatment target for his CBD oil and this CoQ enzyme 10. I hope this CBD oil isn't being used for untreated or undertreated gouty arthritis. I hope this patient isn't a victim of a prescribing cascade where this statin is causing him myalgias, and this is what's prompting his CoQ enzyme 10 usage. And, you know, and of course, I'm also wondering if any other of his medications are causing issues. And I would also want to investigate more into this amlodipine, as I really wouldn't want to give a calcium channel blocker without good reason in someone with cardiomyopathy or heart failure. And so lastly, there are some additional treatment options I would consider at this point. Although RL's EF right now is 53%. GFR, his K are reasonable. Maybe a mineral corticoid receptor antagonist like a spironolactone might be helpful or appropriate. He also seems like he's tolerating his lisinopril, so maybe we would consider transitioning him to Entresto or Sobucatril, Valsartan for that added reduction in mortality risk, you know, as long as his insurance covers. So I have a lot of thoughts on this case, and those are just some of them.
So let's talk about the results of the TREAD-HF study. The official title of the study is Withdrawal of Pharmacologic Treatment for Heart Failure in Patients with Recovered Dilated Cardiomyopathy, TREAD-HF, an open-label pilot randomized trial. Now, first, I think we need to commend the investigators for conducting this study because there is so little information about when and how to stop treatments for chronic diseases. And second, I think they used a pretty innovative study design, which required far fewer subjects than a classic randomized controlled trial. So for those in our audience who haven't read the paper, can you give us a brief summary of the study methods and its major findings?
So yeah, first, I definitely agree we need to thank the study investigators for this work. We do have so many evidence-based guidelines to initiate drug therapy, but so few for discontinuation. So balancing out this equation is so necessary. And yeah, I also agree, pretty innovative and thoughtful study design. So this study, as you said, was an open-label, randomized trial to examine the effects of phased withdrawal of heart failure medications in patients with recovered asymptomatic dilated cardiomyopathy. And so as you can imagine, to be included in this study, patients needed to have, by all kind of biological measures, recovered asymptomatic dilated cardiomyopathy. Without going through all of the inclusion-exclusion criteria, patients need to have a previous diagnosis of dilated cardiomyopathy with an ejection fraction of 40% or lower, but recently or currently had a 50% or greater ejection fraction. they needed to have a normal plasma N-terminal pro-B type natriuretic peptide, or we'll just use BNP for short right now. They couldn't have uncontrolled hypertension. They couldn't have any atrial supraventricular or ventricular arrhythmias. They couldn't have angina, and they couldn't be pregnant. And then, of course, they had to be on medications for heart failure. They could be on loop diuretics, beta blockers, angiotensin conversion, enzyme inhibitors, or ACEs, or ARBs, or mineral corticoid receptor antagonists like spironolactone, or any kind of combination of those. The study included and randomized 51 patients, and these patients were randomly assigned one-to-one to phase withdrawal or continuation of their current treatment. After 6 months, a single crossover arm occurred where the patients that were originally randomized to the continued treatment group also were withdrawn by the same method. The primary endpoint was a relapse of their cardiomyopathy within 6 months. And the study authors defined this by at least one of the following. They had to have a reduction in their ejection fraction by more than 10%. They had to have an increase in their left ventricular end diastolic volume by more than 10%. They had to have a rise in their BNP, or they just needed to have clinical evidence of heart failure based on the signs and symptoms as adjudicated by the research team. And the study authors also had included a lot of secondary outcomes like hospitalizations, a composite safety endpoint. They also looked at changes between baseline and follow-up in their ejection fraction, their BNP levels, their changes in symptom scores, and their exercise time and peak oxygen consumption. They also looked at heart rate and blood pressure. Unfortunately, over the first 6 months, 11 of 25, so 44% of the patients that were randomly assigned to the treatment withdrawal group met the primary endpoint for relapse, compared to none of those that were assigned to the continuation of treatment. And then in the following 6 months, 9 patients, so again, almost 50% of the 26 patients originally randomized to the control group that were then crossed over to the treatment withdrawal group met the primary endpoint of relapse. The study authors noted the following baseline characteristics were associated with an increased risk of relapse. They found advancing age, a prescription for a mineral corticoid receptor antagonist like spironolactone, a prescription of more than 2 heart failure medications, an increased BNP concentration, and a decreased peak global radial strain as, again, a higher risk of relapse. While no deaths and only 3 serious adverse effects led to hospitalizations, the study authors concluded that many patients deemed to have recovered dilated cardiomyopathy will relapse following treatment withdrawal, so treatment should be continued indefinitely.
So tell us, Jen, what are some of the strengths and limitations of the TRED-HF study?
So for me, the key strengths of the study really included the focused and thoughtful inclusion-exclusion criteria and the wide varieties of outcomes that were explored. This study was pretty robust. And I also want to commend the authors on their deprescribing considerations. First, the study authors developed a robust tapering and monitoring protocol to reduce the risk of adverse withdrawal events. Secondly, the participants were not blinded to their assignments. And while normally such a decision would increase bias in a study, it probably is beneficial in deprescribing studies. Literature suggests that patients need to see and feel and be aware of the fact that their medications are being reduced in order to reduce the psychological and psychosocial burden that patients often experience. For me, the limitations of this study include the lack of power to detect clinical outcomes and the single center study design. And then we also need to be careful extrapolating this data to patients with recovered dilated cardiomyopathy secondary to ischemic heart disease or hypertension, because most of the patients in this study suffered from idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy.
So, Jen, the results of the TRED-HF study leave us, I think, in a bit of a quandary. Clearly, there are some patients, indeed about half of the patients enrolled in this study, who did fine when their heart failure treatments were withdrawn. But on the other hand, the risk of relapse was very high. I mean, with nearly half of the patients experiencing one of the endpoints, which in many cases was a biological change that was detected, the authors conclude that essentially heart failure treatment should be continued indefinitely, even in patients who are asymptomatic and appear to have recovered from dilated cardiomyopathy, based on several of these biological measures. On the other hand, one could argue that treating people in this population isn't the best approach, because only 40 to 50% appear to derive a continued benefit. And it's costly, and it exposes half of the patients to potentially unnecessary treatments that might cause adverse effects. So what are your thoughts about the risks and benefits of actually withdrawing treatment in this patient population?
Great question, Siri. You know, as I spoke about before, when we're talking 40 to 50% of patients, you know, when you're getting into that coin flip territory, I think this is really the great opportunity for pharmacists to have those difficult conversations with patients and families and their interprofessional team members. And I think when we take the data available and apply it to the patient in front of us, and when we do a good job of explaining both the risks and benefits of either continuing treatment or stopping treatment with patients, I think it's okay to not treat someone, or in this case, withdraw treatment, if that's really what the patient wants and that's what really aligns with their goals. But I have to admit, after reading this study, my gut is telling me that I wouldn't want to take the risk in patients with recovered dilated cardiomyopathy. Why I still am leaning on continuing treatment is that time until benefit factor. So as you just said, 50% of patients very quickly, within 6 months, started showing signs of a relapse. Something that we haven't talked about yet is that in the TREAD-HF study, of all the patients that met the primary endpoint, they were very quickly restarted on their heart failure medications, and within their next clinic appointment, again, started showing signs of recovery. So for me, I wouldn't want to take the risk for these patients going into the hospital experiencing some of these other signs and symptoms of heart failure, because a lot of times those are the important outcomes that patients either directly or indirectly tell me as a provider is important to them. They want to spend time with their families. They don't want to feel sick. And so for me, I'm still leaning on, we probably should continue them.
So back to RL, what should we do if we assume that RL, in addition to being asymptomatic and having an EF greater than 50%, also having a low N-terminal pro-B type natriuretic peptide concentration, would you even consider discontinuing some or all of his heart failure treatments? And if so, which drugs would you discontinue first? And how would you go about discussing potential treatment changes with the patient?
Ah, Stuart, you know, I'm the D farmer. I was really hoping to answer this question differently. But for me right now, I would still recommend that RL continue it as appropriate. And for me, this is really two reasons that we've just talked about. One, he is someone who has clearly been helped by these medications, as seen by the improvement in his ejection fraction. And two, as we learned in the TREAD-HF study, he would be at a little bit of a higher risk of relapse. He does have advancing age, and he's taking two or more heart failure medications, which they found as a predictor of the primary endpoint. But maybe if we feel his heart failure medications are not deprescribing eligible, there are still ways we could potentially reduce his medication burden. So based on what we know about his case right now, some other medications that might be deprescribing eligible are, again, this CoQ-enzyme 10, this CBD oil, maybe this amlodipine, also maybe his aspirin, or maybe his vitamin D if his vitamin D serum levels have been treated and normalized. If we're still reducing burden and we're still reducing cost potentially, that still might be enough for this patient. When we're discussing these potential treatment changes, they might be met with some concerns with patients. So I tend to use the communication map FRAME. So FRAME stands for F, form or fortify a relationship with the patient. R is recognize willingness to deprescribe. A is align your recommendations to the patient's goals. M stands for manage cognitive dissonance. And E stands for basically empowering the patient to continue deprescribing conversations. So what's great about RL is that we've known him for 20 years. So we definitely already have a relationship with him. We also know that he is willing to deprescribe some of his medications. He's already openly told us that's something that's important to him. What we don't know right away from the details of RL's case, but I'm sure any great ambulatory care pharmacist that cares for a patient like RL for as long as we have, we know a little bit about their goals. And so, A, aligning your recommendations is probably the most crucial part. A lot of times when patients hear, I am stopping something or we can discontinue that, they can feel some concerns. They might feel as if we are abandoning them as healthcare providers, or maybe that their previous attempts at adherence has been futile. You know, there's a wide variety of emotions. So instead of saying, I'm going to stop this or I'm going to optimize this, and I also don't like the terms streamlining, I don't tend to use that in practice. If we say something like, let's say RL likes to garden and hasn't been able to do so because he's feeling fatigued. If we say, you know, RL, I know you like to garden, I want you to feel less fatigued, so let's get rid of this or that. Instead of hearing my healthcare provider is going to stop something, what they'll hear is my healthcare provider knows what is important to me and is working towards it. And so, of course, M stands for managing cognitive dissonance and E stands for empowerment. So if that occurs, that's also something to consider during these conversations. But frame is usually what I stick to, and aligning goals to your recommendations is the key to any type of deprescribing focused conversation.
Jennifer, I can't thank you enough for joining me today to discuss deprescribing and the latest evidence we have about the withdrawal of heart failure treatments in patients with dilated cardiomyopathy who appear to have had a full recovery. I think it's clear from your comments that you believe that heart failure treatments probably need to be continued in the majority of patients, but this is good evidence to share with patients and to have a conversation if they're interested in stopping some of their meds. Well, tell us what you think. Only iFormRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormRx. It's free, so sign up today. And if you happen to be a board-certified ambulatory care pharmacist and would like to earn recertification credit to this program through the American Pharmacists Association, click on the link posted below the commentary on the iFormRx website. And finally, if you like this podcast, consider subscribing using your favorite podcast app, and be sure to tell all of your pharmacy colleagues about iFormRx. We depend on our listeners and members to spread the word, so thanks for listening. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.